Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, and we are going to have a great first-hour conversation, well, a great second-hour conversation for that matter as well. George Lakoff is going to join us the first hour of today's program, author of The Political Mind, Why You Can't Understand 21st Century American Politics with an 18th Century Brain. He is the Richard and Rhoda Goldman Distinguished Professor of Cognitive Science and Linguistics at UC Berkeley, one of the founders of the field of cognitive science, also author of the bestseller Don't Think of an Elephant, Moral Politics, Who's Freedom, and many books and articles on cognitive science and linguistics. He says progressives have accepted an old view of reason that dates back to the Enlightenment, namely that reason is conscious, literal, logical, universal, unemotional, disembodied, and serve self-interest. As the cognitive and brain sciences have been showing, this is a false view of reason. Oddly enough, this matters. Suppose the 21st century understanding of the brain and the mind were widely known and fully appreciated, what might change? We're happy to have Professor Lakoff with us this first hour, and our number to join the conversation is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. And again, if you'd like to send an email, which you're perfectly welcome to do, that's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor George Lakoff, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Kathleen.
You say that human beings are not the rational creatures that we've so long imagined ourselves to be. We're not?
No, not at all.
No.
I haven't said that. I've said that rationality isn't what we thought it to be. We're very rational. It's just that the view of what rationality consists of is incorrect. And scientifically incorrect.
And what is that view of rationality?
The traditional view is, just as you were saying, that our reason is conscious, that emotion gets in the way of reason, that our reason is logical. If you tell someone the facts, they will reason it through logically to the right conclusion, that reason is literal. It fits the world directly. That reason is universal. Everybody has the same reason. That reason is disembodied, abstract. And moreover, that reason is mainly there to serve our interests and our purposes. That is the traditional view of reason. It comes from the Enlightenment. And what cognitive science and neuroscience have shown is that each piece of that is false.
Mm-hmm.
So let's take consciousness.
Okay.
About 98% of our reasoning is unconscious. It's what our brain is doing when we don't notice. Ideas are physically in our brain. They're not disembodied. They're not floating in air. You can't do anything without your brain. Basically, all thought involves your brain. If you learn something new, you've changed your brain. If you've changed somebody's mind, you've changed their brains. So it's not disembodied. It's physically there. Moreover, it doesn't just fit the world as it is. When we think in terms of structures called frames and conceptual metaphors. And this is something people aren't widely aware of, but framing is normal. Every idea you have has a structure, and that structure is fairly uniform in terms of what is called framing. That is, the ideas have what are called semantic rules. Let me give you something.
Sure.
This is really simple. Sorry. Let's get away from politics for a minute and think about what a hospital is like.
Mm-hmm.
You have doctors, you have nurses, orderlies, scalpels, operating rooms, etc. Those are somatic roles. They're roles that people and places and instruments play in a hospital. There are scenarios that you go through in a hospital. Doctors operate on patients. All ideas are structured in terms of these notions of somatic roles, of scenarios, relations between the roles, and so on. Those are normal, and all words are defined relative to those structures. those structures are not just floating in air. They are physically realized in your brain.
Hmm.
That's what makes this interesting. That means that you can't just see the world in itself and understand the world in itself. You're always understanding the world through your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And you're understanding the world through your frames. In addition, you think in terms of conceptual metaphors. Well, what does that mean? Take a very simple example. More is up and less is down. Prices rise and they fall. They don't literally rise and fall. They metaphorically rise and fall. Or there are warm people and cold people. Well, they may not literally be warm or cold, but they're affectionate or unaffectionate. This is not just a matter of words. It's the way you think about things. You understand achieving a purpose as reaching a goal, as reaching a location in space, a destination. That is normal throughout the world. Why should this be so? It turns out we now understand why. Let's take more is up. When any child sees water going into a glass or anything being piled on a desk, two parts of their brain are active, quantity and verticality. In different parts of their brain, there's a correlation between adding more stuff and seeing the level go up. Every day of their lives, this is true. We all experience this. When that happens in two parts of our brain, those parts of the brain become active. When neural structures become active, they spread by what is called spreading activation along neural pathways. As the activation spreads over and over and over every single day when you see these things correlate, they tend to get stronger, the pathways get stronger, until you get a meeting of the pathways spreading out from these two centers, and then they form a circuit. That circuit is the metaphor that more is up. Same thing happens with affection is warmth. You're held affectionately as a child. That correlates with an increase in temperature. Every time you're held affectionately, you experience an emotion and temperature rise.
Hmm.
That gives rise to activation in your brain. It spreads, forms a circuit, and you get the metaphor that affection is warmth. There are hundreds of these, and your brain is shaped by them just by living in the world, and you don't know it because it's part of that 98% that's unconscious.
And so fit in values. You talk a lot about values, and a basic value of Americans is empathy, that American values are fundamentally progressive. Does that fit into what you just talked about?
Well, yes, and in a very deep way. There is a remarkable discovery made about 12 years ago in Parma, Italy, what were called mirror neurons. Mirror neurons work like this. Let me try to explain it. There was an experiment done with macaque monkeys at first where you had the monkey's brain exposed. And there was a probe put in the brain so that whenever a monkey performed an action that it was trained to do, the probe in the premotor cortex, which is where actions are choreographed, would fire. You could tell which neurons were firing whenever the monkey performed a particular action. Different neurons would fire with different actions. They trained it to peel a banana, press a bar, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
One day, an experimenter went out for lunch, came back, saw a pile of bananas, started to peel one, and heard the machine that was registering this go click, 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 click. But it was it was tied to the monkey, not to him. What he discovered was that these neurons fire when either the monkey performed an action or saw someone else performing the same one. Okay, it turns out people have mirror neurons too, and they work this way, and they are connected to the emotional regions of the brain. That is why you can tell when someone else is afraid or angry or happy or sad, because you can see what their body is like relative to the emotions, then you can feel that in yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you can feel someone else's pain. We are physically set up to have empathy, not just self-interest, but empathy. It's a major part of our life, and that's how we connect socially to other people. Now, what's important about this has to do with the idea that reason is just about self-interest and that our democracy is based on self-interest. There's mm-hmm. a tradition that says, well, you know, democracy is just maximizing people's interests. It turns out that that's not exactly true. There's a study by historian Lynn Hunt at UCLA called Inventing Human Rights. And she asked an important question. She looked at the Declaration of Independence, where it said, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all people are created equal, etc.
Right.
And she then asked, when did it become self-evident? So she went back to the Enlightenment in the 1600s, and looking at Enlightenment reason and Enlightenment politics, it wasn't self-evident. You know, not in the 1600s. She looked at the 1700s. 1700 to 1725, not self-evident. 1725 to 1750, not self-evident. Around 1750, it becomes self-evident. How? It turns out that the reason is that around this time, you started getting stories and drawings of people in the lower classes who were tortured, who were, taken advantage of, etc. And these stories and pictures aroused empathy. By 1776, it was self-evident in France, England, and America through empathy. And she concludes that the basis of American democracy is really empathy.
Interesting. You bring this up to the current campaign and talk about during the conservative reign, which we've had for some years now, we've seen what Barack Obama has called an empathy deficit.
Yes. It's a very important thing. And the pundits who talk about Obama don't listen to him. They don't notice it. But it's there. In the Selma speech, he repeatedly talks about the empathy deficit. When he talks in the Philadelphia speech, the speech on race, he says that we have to improve upon our basic ideals that founded the country. We need more freedom, more fairness, and more caring and more opportunity. More caring, right in the middle of that. The next day, he's asked by Anderson Cooper, what is your view of patriotism? And he says, patriotism begins with caring about each other. That's why we have ideals like freedom and fairness. He's asked a week later by Ann Curry, what's the most important thing your mother taught you? He says, empathy, putting yourself in someone else's shoes. That's the basis of human kindness. That's what political leadership should be about. Right? Very clear, and if you look at the way he tells stories, they're all about building empathy. Right? That is what comes across. It's central to the campaign. No one discusses it, but it's what people feel.
And it's not just, as you write, feeling empathy. It also means taking responsibility.
It means taking responsibility. The basis of progressive thought is empathy, caring about people, but acting responsibly, both for yourself and others, acting socially responsibly. And that is right at the center of the Obama campaign again. You know, here's a guy who got out of Harvard Law School, could have gone into any major Wall Street firm, and decided to become a community organizer to help poor people.
So how have conservatives reigned for so long? Is it that they have framed the debate on certain issues more effectively? And if so, how have they done that?
Well, they've done two things. First, through a system of think tanks started in the 70s, basically, they have figured out what conservatism is about, and they have figured out what the basic ideas of conservatism are about the nature of government, about the nature of security, taxation, responsibility, family values, and so on. And then they've applied it to every possible area. And they've done this through a system of think tanks that now is so large, they spend $400 million a year on them. And they've been training people in a language of those values for 35 years. And they've got a system of talk radio and, video contacts and so on that puts those ideas out there every day. When you hear the language, the ideas register automatically in your brain. If you hear them over and over, your brain has changed. There's nothing you can do about it. They become physically part of your brain. That's how conservatives have gotten their ideas out there. But they've done something else as well that is very clever. Back in the 1960s, everybody assumed that the Democratic Party was the party of working people. The conservatives decided this wasn't a good idea. They wanted to take over as many working people as they could with their ideas. And what they did was they invented the idea that liberals are elites. And they kept saying it over and over. There's
right.
The tax and spend liberals, the liberal media, the liberal elite, the limousine liberals, the latte liberals, and so on. Over the sushi eating, Birkenstock wearing. You got over and over and over. So the idea was that liberals were supposed to be looking down on working people when, in fact, they were the people fighting for working people's rights. Now, you repeat it over and over for 40 years, and it starts to change people's brains. Now, they also noticed that a lot of working people were what I call biconceptual. That is, they were conservative in some ways and liberal in others. They might be liberal on their unions or their working life, on their relationship to nature, on their communities, but they were very often conservative in their family life and in their social attitudes. So what conservatives did was start talking about and making issues of their social attitudes about, let's say, abortion or gay marriage and so on. And in doing that, what they did was activate the conservative parts of their brains, making the synapses stronger and stronger so that they could spread to other areas, while they've inhibited the liberal parts of their brains through the liberal elite idea. What they did by repeating all this over and over for so long was create the idea of a conservative populism. And that is what Democrats didn't understand. John Edwards thought populism was about economics purely. It's not. People are voting their identities. They're voting who they most centrally are. And what the conservatives have done for a lot of working people is convince them simply through language that their central identity is their family and their social attitudes, not their economics, and that liberals are elites and looking down on them.
And what about this continuum in the brain? You write about that. Do we have a left-to-right continuum? Are we more left or more right? Can we move depending on the language that's given to us?
Well, in fact, we're not. The idea that there is a liberal to conservative, left to right continuum is actually false. And it turns out that a lot of people have learned both a conservative mode of reasoning and a liberal mode of reasoning, but they're abstract modes of reasoning and can apply to different particular issues. You can be liberal on foreign policy and conservative on economic policy, or the reverse. Compare Joe Lieberman and Chuck Hagel. Chuck Hagel is, you know, against the war but very conservative. Lieberman is pro-war but fairly liberal. They agree on very little, but they're both called moderates because they're neither one or the other fully. But there is no ideology of the middle. There is no moderate ideology. There's no left-to-right scale. It's just combinations of all sorts.
And yet we've been told by people for years now that that's where the American people are. They're moderates.
They're moderates. Well, what happened, what we're saying, what is really being said is a lot of people are progressive in some ways and liberal in others, but they're all over the place. Now, what's interesting about this is that in the campaign, you had both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama who talk about bipartisanship. And it turns out they mean opposite things. Hillary Clinton, when she talks about being bipartisan, means that when she has to, she will compromise by adopting conservative ideas. That's what she calls moving to the center.
Right.
She will adopt ideas that go against progressive morality. Obama does the reverse. Obama understands that there are a lot of conservatives who actually have progressive ideas on certain issues. So what he does is seek out the conservatives who already agree with him. on those ideas and talk to them on that basis so that he doesn't have to adopt conservative ideas at all.
Oh, that's interesting.
Right? Now, he is criticized on the, in this way by conservatives. So you get conservative columnists constantly say he's not really a bipartisan because he doesn't go into the bipartisan caucuses, which means he's not ready to give up his moral ideas. He's, in fact, looking for conservatives who agree with him on these issues.
We're going to welcome phone calls for George. George Lakoff is our guest. He is the author, most recently, of The Political Mind, Why You Can't Understand 21st Century American Politics with an 18th Century Brain. He's a distinguished professor of cognitive science and linguistics at UC Berkeley and one of the founders of the field of cognitive science, also author of the bestseller Don't Think of an Elephant. We're welcoming phone calls for Professor Lakoff, and here's how you reach us. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. And if you want to send an email, that's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor George Lakoff is our guest this hour, author of The Political Mind. Our number is 800-486-8655. The lines are filled, but keep trying, and eventually you'll get through. Carol from Muscadet is our first caller.
Thank
George.
You.
Hi, Carol.
Hi. This is so stimulating. There are a million questions, of course. Dr. Lakoff, could you comment on the German, the recent German experiments with the decision-making in the brain, tracking that in the brain and finding that, you know, much as you were talking about the macaque, the monkeys, et cetera, that this is so, you know, some huge percent of it is happening in the emotional centers. Then secondly, I have another question. Could you address what seems to be the fact that the Nazi propagandists really understood what you're talking about in a way that, let's say, the Republicans do? And third, from where I'm sitting emotionally, I think that Hillary Clinton is the is a pure manifestation of empathy. You know, that's my emotional take on it. But isn't that the way politics goes? So those three points. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, first, decision-making. You have to understand a couple of things about the way emotions work in the brain. There are two major pathways for emotions, a positive one and a negative one, with two different neurotransmitters, dopamine in the positive one, norepinephrine in the negative one. The positive pathways goes past those parts of the brain which, when activated, lead you to feel happy, satisfied, or awesome, and so on. The negative pathways go past parts of the brain which, when activated, lead you to feel fearful, anxious, and angry. Now, those pathways are connected to other parts of the brain that have to do with narrative structures, with the way that you understand yourself in terms of cultural narratives. For example, if you have a rags-to-riches narrative, and you identify with a protagonist who is poor, and they encounter problems, and you feel sorry for them, and then as they succeed, you feel happier for them, and so on. Or suppose you have a hero-villain narrative where some terrible thing happens to somebody and you feel angry. And then a hero comes along to encounter the villain, and you don't know if the hero is going to win, and you feel anxious and fearful. When the hero wins, you feel satisfied and happy. These are structures in the brain that are activated over and over. They have an intellectual side and a an emotional side, and they're not separated. They're physically linked in the brain. They're part of structures of that sort. And these ideas come up in politics all the time. So, for example, if you're fighting a war, then the other guys are the villains and you're the heroes, and you insist on victory, and there's an emotional part of it. And you can express fear, you know. And if you are telling a rags-to-riches story, you get the other sort of emotions. This is normal. When you make decisions, it turns out you use frames, narratives, and metaphors all the time. Sorry. That means that emotions are being used in making decisions. There's no way to avoid it. Think of it this way. Suppose your brain was injured and you couldn't feel emotion. Could you be rational? The answer is no, you could not, because you wouldn't know what to want. You know, you wouldn't know whether, if you got it, you would feel happy or sad or nothing, and you wouldn't know how other people would feel. So people who have such brain injuries can't be rational. They can't act. They don't know what to do. They can't make decisions. Emotion is absolutely necessary for it, and you're right. With respect to the Nazis, yes, they had what I've called a strict father morality, and a morality based on authority and discipline, and there was a lot of that within German culture that they called upon that was there in advance. What you have with a lot of the right wing in America is they're calling upon similar ideas, not as extreme as the Nazis by any means. I'm not calling anybody Nazis. But in terms of the basic ideas about authority, those basic ideas are there in conservatism, although they're not used anywhere near with anywhere near that extreme. In terms of Hillary Clinton, she has a mixture of empathy, but also she talks constantly about interests. And in fact, her policies are based on interest group politics. What she tends to do is find an interest group that has been ill-served either by the market or by government, and then propose a program for that interest group, hoping that they'll vote for her. So she'll go to Pennsylvania, talk to people who've lost their jobs through outsourcing, and says, I have a program for retraining people who are just in your in what you're doing. It's a $2 billion program, et cetera. It turns out that she's trying to get at empathy via interests, and that's very different from what Obama is doing. Really very, very different idea. It's not that she doesn't have empathy, but she has a very different approach to it.
Don't you think, though, that he's picked up on some of that when she was doing well in some of the primaries, that you found him giving a little bit more of a laundry list to those various constituents? This is what needs to happen with your group, et cetera.
Yeah, he started doing that, and it didn't work, and he stopped.
All right.
And what happened was Hillary was doing that from the beginning, and it didn't work. And there's a very deep reason for this that is usually not understood. And it's the reason that Ronald Reagan did so well. Ronald Reagan's chief strategist was Richard Werthelin. I spoke at length to Werthelin about his experience with Reagan. And what Werthelin told me was very interesting. He said when he started to work for Reagan, he did his first poll. People did not like Reagan's positions on issues, but they wanted to vote for Reagan. Mm. He didn't understand why, but he was the chief strategist, so he'd better figure it out.
Yeah, right.
So he went and interviewed people, and what he found out was Reagan mainly talked about values, and when he talked about issues, they exemplified values, and that's what people cared about. He also was a very good communicator. He connected with people. They cared about that. People felt that he told the truth, that he said what he believed, that he was authentic, so they cared about authenticity. And if you know somebody's values, even if you disagree with them and they think they're telling you the truth, you can at least trust them. You know where they stand. And if they're connecting and communicating with you, you can identify with them. That's what happened with Reagan. And Bush ran a campaign of the same kind. The Democrats never quite got it until this year. All the Democratic candidates, kept running campaigns based on positions on issues. And what happened this year was remarkable. Obama came out, running on values, authenticity, trust, communication. And Hillary came out running on positions on issues and programs. And it turned out that Obama connected with people and Hillary didn't until Pennsylvania. And when she was losing with the other strategy, she shifted. And she adopted this strategy, but it was too late.
Yeah. And tell me how, I've been trying to figure this out here and how it'll play out in the months ahead. How did the constant repetition of Jeremiah Wright's comments, which seem to fly in the face of what you've just described as who Obama is, what does that do to him? What does that do to his campaign? It's not really empathy that he is espousing, Wright, that is.
Well, that's exactly the point. If you look at attacks, you can see the structure of the campaign. Those attacks are not random. The attack was on whether on Obama's values, on whether he was authentic, whether he said mm-hmm. whether he believed, and whether you could trust him. That was exactly the point of those attacks via Jeremiah Wright. Now, think about the word pastor. When did you hear the word pastor before the last couple of months? You know, very rarely. It's mm-hmm. not exactly a common word. But it became very common, and it was used over and over. Why? The word pastor comes with a metaphor, and the metaphor is that of the shepherd and sheep and his flock, right? The minister is supposed to be a shepherd, and the people in the church are seen as the flock by a metaphor. And that means that whatever the pastor says, the flock is going to follow. That's the inference. Now, of course, it's not true, but that doesn't matter because the metaphor is there as soon as you use the word pastor. It's structured, and therefore you can take the words of the pastor and attribute it to the person in the church. That is the logic behind it. It's a phony logic, but it's there. It's real. It's in people's brains. And that's what the Republicans were trying to do and what Hillary Clinton was mm-hmm. trying to do.
Let's go to Craig from Madison next. Hi, Craig. Hello, Craig. Are you there? Well, Craig is gone. So we go to Mark from – hi, Mark.
Good morning.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you guys doing? This is just a very fascinating, very interesting, fascinating discussion that you guys are having this morning. Stumbled across it on the radio driving into Madison. And I guess the question I have is, you talk a lot about, obviously we've learned from your discussion, we've learned a lot about how the brain functions, the things, the patterns and the development and so forth and so on. And you talked just now about things like truth, where people would consider certain things to be so based on, or I should say trust. You're talking about trust and recognizing, you know, through your brain certain patterns that a person might say agree with or is consistent with their upbringing and so forth and so on. Could you talk a little bit about maybe things that are a little bit more or less scientific, so to speak, in say like things like truth or justice or say for instance you know say more nebulous things like spiritual or things like God. Could you talk a little bit about those things and how they or do they fit in what you're talking about in terms of the scientific aspect of the brain and how it has developed and functioned?
Okay, small topics like truth, justice, and God.
Right.
Okay, but there are some things to say. First, as a cognitive scientist, what you do is study how people understand things. So how do you understand the concept of God? It turns out you understand the concept of God via metaphor. God is ineffable. You have no choice. You're going to be using metaphors. And there are four classes of metaphors. The first are the metaphors of God as a person, usually centering around a father or parent. The classic includes things like special cases, like God not only as father, but also God as lawgiver, God as judge, God as shepherd, etc. Lots and lots of metaphors for God that way. There's also God as the infinite, and special cases like the all-knowing, the first cause, the all-powerful, the all-good. Those are the infinity metaphors. Those are the two that are most common. But in the Western tradition, there are other metaphors for God. One is God is the source of all good things. You also get the idea of God as the physical world, called panentheism or sometimes pantheism, but where God is, actually in the world in itself. So you have a tradition where you say God is. Do not say God is not in the stone. God is in the stone. God is in the tree. You know, etc. And God is in the fertilizer. it's there, right there, in various religious traditions. People who call themselves atheists are people who usually reject the first two metaphors, but often accept the last two, but don't use the word God for them. And so they often are very spiritual people. With respect to the notion of justice, justice is based on a metaphor of what's called moral accounting. So, for example, suppose I do you a favor. You say, I owe you one. I'm in your debt. It's as if I gave you money. So you have a metaphor based upon money for an accounting metaphor, and justice is balancing the books. So if I repay you, I can repay the favor. Suppose I harm you, there are several ways of balancing the books. One, I could do something to make up for it. That's restitution. You could do something to harm me back. That's retribution. I could do something to take something good away from you. That's revenge, and so on. And there are different systems of justice based on all of these. But the very concept of justice is based on moral accounting and on that metaphor. Truth is a very important idea. And notice that since you don't encounter the world directly, you only encounter it through your brain and through the frames and metaphors and narratives in your brain. Truth is based on understanding. And when your experience of the world fits your understanding of the world in terms of these frames and metaphors and so on, that's when you say something is true.
Thank you so much for the call. You right. Let's go back to this idea of conservatives being able to use language and ideas, images, symbols to activate the conservative mode of thought and inhibit the progressive mode of thought in individuals who had both. You have a chapter on how progressives can reverse this process. What do you say?
Well, they can reverse it by, again, first noticing that people are biconceptual. And that a lot of people who call themselves conservatives around the country often have progressive views, and it's kind of systematic. If you go through the Midwest and Far West, and you go through small towns where there are lots of conservatives, and you talk to them about the land, it turns out they love the land as much as any environmentalist. But they wouldn't use the word environmentalist for themselves. If you talk to them about their communities, it turns out they want to live in a community where the people who run the community care about them, where they're responsible people, where people care about each other and act responsibly toward each other and respectfully. That's a progressive community. They don't call it a progressive community, but that fits progressive values. If you look at small business throughout the Midwest and the West, what you find are business people who are basically honest, honorable, who don't harm their employees, who treat their employees well, and would never harm the public. Those are business people who are basically progressive. They fit the progressive idea of what business should be, but they would never call themselves progressives. If you look at religion, it turns out that throughout the Midwest and West, you have a religion in which God is not a strict father that acts punitively, but is a nurturant parent who is forgiving and who seeks to have you heal the sick and take care of the poor and so on, basically a progressive view of God. When you go through people who call themselves conservatives throughout the country, you find attitudes like this. And this is what Obama is banking on in unifying the country.
More phone calls in just one moment. Our conversation this hour is with Professor George Lakoff. He's the author, most recently, of The Political Mind, Why You Can't Understand 21st Century American Politics with an 18th Century Brain. Professor Lakoff is Distinguished Professor of Cognitive Science and Linguistics at UC Berkeley and one of the founders of the field of cognitive science. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send an email, that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, we're going to be talking about the media and this campaign and how special interest groups have pulled ads from the air. But most importantly, we'll be looking at a major study done from UW-Madison that looks at the amount of money spent in this presidential campaign. And the headlines are saying that an edge in 11-day span boosted Obama and probably secured him the nomination, which may happen tonight. By the way, we'll be talking about what happens tonight, tomorrow, during our 9 o'clock hour. Back to phone calls for George Lakoff. Oh, actually, let's take an email. Here's an email, George. Hold on a second. Can you ask your guest if art is important in helping us retain our empathy and emotions as we grow older? People involved in art seem to be more empathetic and liberal. Is it possible that technology has allowed us to share art and that has helped us become more empathetic in modern times? I personally believe that as we grow older, we become less empathetic, and this might lead us to becoming conservative as we age.
Well, several things. First, art is important in developing empathy. It is crucial in developing empathy. And it's not just as you grow older, it's crucial in children. The basic thing about education to remember is that between the time we are born and the time we're 5 years old, half of our neural connections die.
Isn't
the question
that
something? Is, which half? Our brain is shaped fundamentally in those first 5 years. And it's very important that children hear music, that they engage in art, that they get an aesthetic sense, that they connect with the world, connect with nature aesthetically. That is what empathy is. It is connection. It is connection to the world. And what art does is connect your body, your visual sense, your musical sense, your sense of language, to the world in general. That's why it develops empathy. And that's why conservatives tend to want to cut art programs.
Let's go to more phone calls. We go to Tom from Burlington. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. I was a page in Washington, and I met most of the presidents since Truman. And I'm a songwriter, and I was 14 years old, and the page bench is right in the back of the House of Representatives. And when the House was finished every day, I would sing in the House of Representatives, and because the acoustics there are just wonderful. And my father was a member of Congress, and he was the man who put through the 1957 Civil Rights Bill. And he was on the Appropriations Committee, the Defense Appropriations Committee, which is a very, very powerful committee. They have this show out called Charlie's War, and Charlie was on the Appropriations Committee too. When you hold the dollars, people have to do what you want them to do, and that's how he was a very powerful man with Sam Rayburn. Sam Rayburn didn't have a father, he wasn't married, and he had no children, and he kind of took my father under his wing. But I'd like to say something about Hillary's campaign now that it is over with her almost. She was never put in the right setting. Candidate has to find their setting. She would be in these large halls and making these speeches, and she would come off being shrill. And the time in New Hampshire when she was sitting down at that table, which was really her setting, they didn't really pick up on that and use it. What happened with Mr. Obama and with the pastor problem, it really turned out to be not a problem at all. It was basically a blessing in disguise because there was a perception among people that he was a Islamist. So with all that, the press there showing him with his pastor, it kind of wiped out that problem because that that no longer exists. But now, to your thing, I'm one of these bi people who was, I'm against abortion, terribly, terribly against it, but I'm also support civil unions. And poor Kathleen Dunn has heard me talk about civil unions till for 2 or 3 years.
A few times, Tom, yeah.
But when I talked about civil unions, I would never, ever use the word justice. I would always appeal to what is the economic benefit of having civil unions. And maybe I had made a mistake, and I'd like to I should have maybe talked about the justice.
Okay, let's get a response. Go ahead, George.
Do you have a question?
My question is, if I was trying to push something across, maybe I should have talked in terms of justice, it being a justice, issue. But I didn't. I never ever used the word justice. And
should he have used justice?
Yes. I think so. I think justice, and I think it's a freedom issue. There's a question of freedom to marry. It wasn't that long ago that interracial couples were not allowed to marry in many states in this country. Luckily, that changed. And in California now and in Massachusetts, couples who are gay are as free to marry as anybody else. But the issue is liberty, not enough progressives talk about freedom and liberty when they should be. I mean, that is, the essence of progressive America. They've allowed the conservatives to take over the words freedom and liberty. So that's part of this. The question about Hillary Clinton is really right. And it's something I spent some years trying to get her folks to change. When I first met Hillary Clinton, I spent some time with her, sitting down in the drawing room next to her office in the Capitol, and found her a very warm person, very personable, very straightforward, honest with me. We disagreed about many things, but straightforwardly and with no rancor whatever, I found her a delightful person. And personally, I like her. But she was put in this position. She told me then, she felt she had to look strong.
Right.
And when she looked strong, she wasn't herself. She wasn't authentic. It wasn't the true Hillary, And what she found after, and people in her campaign tried occasionally to tell her that, but they were the younger people in the campaign, who had just come aboard and had tried to soften Hillary. And the older people said, no, you've got to look strong, look strong, look strong. Eventually, she found out that wasn't exactly who she was in general when she was shrill. But then she found a different way of being strong. That was in the Pennsylvania campaign when she lowered her voice and she became the friend of the working man. And, even though she'd gone to Wellesley and Yale Law School and lived in the governor's mansion and the White House, she was the friend of the working man. But there's some authentic voice that came out there that people sensed.
Right.
And I think it's real. And I think Hillary did herself a disservice. I think her advisors did her a great disservice.
Here's an interesting email from Paul and Monona, and you write extensively about this in your book. There's certainly not now and never was a war in Iraq. Occupation is an emotionally unpleasant word. It is the correct term for what is happening in Iraq. I feel the media is being bullied mafiosa style at times, and when they see a need by the Bush administration not to use this term or anything like it, how would we combat that?
Well, it's very important, as she said, to tell the truth by using the right language. The word war evokes a frame in which you are fighting one army, fighting another army for control of territory. That's not what's been happening in Iraq since May 2003, when Saddam Hussein's army was defeated. Since then, we've had an occupation. And the idea that you can have victory in an occupation doesn't make any sense. you know, and all you can do in an occupation is eventually leave. So it's important to talk about it that way. And in the 2006 election, only one senatorial candidate actually did. That was Chuck Webb. Hmm. I mean, sorry, Jim Webb. Mm-hmm. Jim Webb went out and actually talked about occupation. Obama has occasionally used the word, and nobody noticed. Mm-hmm. But he's more often used war. Every time you use war, the war frame has victory built in, and then you allow McCain to come on and say, we have to have victory, we can't have defeat, you're a defeatist, etc. But the word occupation has a problem, and that is if your son is dying, has died in Iraq, mm-hmm. or has been mortally wounded, or maimed.
We have 5 seconds.
How can you do it? How can you say he died for an occupation?
Right. Interesting. Well, you were just a great guest. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's a real pleasure, Kathleen.
George Lakoff, The Political Mind, Why You Can't Understand 21st Century American Politics with an 18th Century Brain, was our guest this hour. We'll have him back. He gets you thinking, huh? Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, John Treader for on-air production. We return following the news.